Thank you very much indeed. So we're going to just to move on now, just to look about, you know, what's the implications of all of this after having looked at the context. So I'm delighted that we have Jeremy Skinner, who's head of strategic project and policy evaluation at the GLA. So Jeremy.
Thank you very much. I'll just capable. Thank you very much, Barbara. I thought I'd try and present an overview schematic of London's demography, which is encapsulated on this picture, which colleagues at the GLA have tried to construct for me. And this really has some of the flows and also includes the births and the deaths to provide some picture of what's happened to London over the last 5 years' worth of data. Now, before I go on, I should say that I'm not an expert in immigration statistics. We've heard the detailed context, perhaps, which has gone down to even more detail, and I'm stepping even further back. And I'm not actually responsible for the London Plan either. However, I am leading a piece of work looking at London's infrastructure requirements, which I'll come on to. And I guess my sort of overall contention is that the main implication of London's immigration is that it's contributing to London's overall growth. Secondly, that era of growth, or we're entering into a new era of growth, which we have not experienced before, and that thirdly, we need to provide for that growth in ways that, again, we have not really considered before, and I'll come on to each of those. But this graph sort of sets the overall context, because I think it's very important to have some understanding of the overall flows in and out of the city in order to understand what's going on. And really, these numbers present the question really within the reader's mind as to whether they're high or low. I don't think there's any right or wrong answer to that, whether the fact that each year 150,000 people from overseas go into inner London, as we have at the top, representing approximately 1.8% of the stock of London's population. Whether that's large or small, I don't know. But certainly over a decade, that would amount to quite a substantial change in London's population. Or that there is a flight of around about 160,000 per annum from outer London to the rest of the UK, again represented by that big bar in the middle, somewhat more than 1.8%. Again, over the course of a decade, that will change the city quite considerably. So these are value judgments that one each has. I think the historic record is, though, that over the long term, we have witnessed similar periods of growth in the past, but mostly driven, as one of the previous speakers said, by the natural growth rate in the population and rather less by immigration. And then, of course, the city is simply changing because of the births and deaths. In inner London, a large town is born each year, a small suburb passes away, and in outer London, a small city arises and a rather large suburb demises. Are these flows big or small? I think I really have to leave it to you to decide. Representing the same data in a slightly more digestible way, you know, the scorecard, the ins and the outs. Inner London, significantly more births than deaths. Inner London, migration from overseas, very significantly more than the out migration. The in migration from the rest of the UK, balancing out the out migration to the rest of the UK. In outer London, the births considerably exceeding the deaths, the immigration out from overseas somewhat greater than the out migration to overseas, And finally, as we've noted before, a very significant increase in the population, a very significant exit from London to the rest of the UK compared to the in-migration from the rest of the UK. All that leads to a sort of net growth of around about 150,000, 146,000 per annum, of which migration makes up approximately half, and net migration from the international side makes up a very significant proportion. So the question for us really as policymakers is, well, what do you do about this? Because that is really fundamentally what we're interested in focusing on. Now, there are various policies which the mayor has in terms of helping migrant communities integrate. English as a foreign language, English as a second or other language, and so on and so forth. But for those of us who concentrate on London's planning, its economic growth, it is sustaining and accommodating that growth, which is the thing which is we focus on most. We kicked off some work last summer looking at London's infrastructure needs over the foreseeable future, and we are looking at London's infrastructure to around about 2050, given how long it takes projects like Crossrail to gestate. We think that's a reasonably short time frame. And taking the long record back to the first census in 1801, the central projection doesn't actually look particularly unlikely to happen. We are projecting a potential population growth population of 11.3 million by the end of that forecasting period, based on an employment growth trend of 2.5%. But in some respects, this picture of London's population, which I always find fascinating, the thing which I find most interesting is that we are about to exceed our previous 1939 peak of 8.6 million. Within the next 12 months. In fact, if we are to interpolate the figures provided by our statisticians, mark the 6th of January 2015 in your diaries as the date when you may find the Mayor of London wandering the maternity wards of London trying to find the baby that represents this mark in London's population history. So the work that we are doing is really to think about the infrastructure requirements of the capital. And in terms of infrastructure, the scope of that includes public transport, roads, housing to the extent that we're thinking about the overall quantum and the approximate location where that housing may go, and the cost of social housing that might be provided. We are excluding from scope the need to increase the overall supply of housing from something like the mid-20,000s per annum currently to nearer 42,000 to 50,000 per annum over the long term if we are to accommodate this central projection. Energy, particularly gas and electricity, water, the supply of potable water, sewerage and flood defence, waste infrastructure, in particular a greater focus on the recycling of waste. We've seen commodity prices rise significantly over the last 10 years, despite a significant recession in the West. And there is a stronger private sector appetite to invest more in waste recycling facilities. Green infrastructure, where we typically think of our green infrastructure, the network of local parks, rivers and so on, but which are often not managed in a networked way or considered in terms of their contribution for providing green thoroughways and contributions to flood defences. And social infrastructure, we have limited to the question of how many schools, and classrooms need to be provided. We may look at some aspects of healthcare, although models of healthcare change significantly over the sort of periods we're looking at. And so, therefore, we have excluded that from the scope at the moment. The other thing that we're trying to do is to try and cost what the central projection of those infrastructure requirements might look like. This is part of a general argument that we have on an annual basis with government about funding for capital projects in particular, but is somewhat more nuanced now with the publication of Toner's excellent work on the London Finance Commission recommending fiscal devolution to the capital, which, by the way, is going to be granted largely in full for the Welsh Government and National Assembly for Wales, with the publication a few days ago of the Wales Bill, which will recommend pretty much, or sorry, which will see the enactment of pretty much everything that we recommended in the London Finance Commission in Wales, namely the devolution of business rates, stamp duty, and some other property-based taxes. The question of where all that growth is going to happen is one where we are assessing a number of different scenarios. To what extent the growth might be accommodated outside? Probably not significantly, given the growth in the rest of London and the South East. However, that leads to the problem of how we may accommodate growth within London's existing borders. A 37% rise in the population from 2011 to 2050 obviously has a commensurate rise in the density in what is already a relatively dense city, particularly in outer London. And there are particular factors that we are also considering, such as whether and where aviation capacity may go in the city. But just to give some idea of the scale of infrastructure demand that is likely to be recommended under our central scenario, perhaps up to a 60% increase in trips, continuing shift away from the car, increasingly dense development, all that is going to require substantial investment in transport. Transport is, which that is the thing that makes cities tick. It's the leading form of infrastructure in terms of what makes cities work. We're building Crossrail now, which will be open in 2018. We think that Crossrail 2, running from the southwest to the northeast, probably in a regional scheme extending beyond London's boundaries, and potentially across Rail 3, where there are a number of candidates for the route, but essentially mass transit from outer to central London, where we project most of the jobs will continue to be, where new jobs will exist in future. A new emphasis from this mayoralty on putting roads into tunnels, releasing development land above them, not least to help pay for them and also make the environment better, tube and overground extensions, etc. I've mentioned the figures on housing. It is not quite clear to me or really to anyone how we will achieve such a target of 50,000 per annum. Clearly a step change is required. And an increase in the school age population equivalent to over 6,000 primary classes, or around about 300 some medium-sized primary schools during that period, nearly 4,000 secondary school classes, or somewhat over 100 new schools. Not each year, sorry, that's the wrong. 130 new schools to in the period of 2050. And in some areas, of course, we're seeing a high risk of demand outstripping supply already, particularly in electricity provision. And that demand will increase. So, to conclude, I think there are a number of sort of value judgments that need to be made, which in some respects can only be done personally, about the population flows in and out within the capital, the UK, between inner and outer London. I think there are some deeply local effects that some of the people in this room have been commenting on. The overall imperative is the contribution of all that immigration to London's growth, for which we are starting to develop a plan. We are entering a new era of growth from the 6th of January next year. The costs of supporting it literally have yet to be understood. That is the work we are concluding now. And my sort of overall plea is that this pattern of growth is something that we have seen for the last 200 years and is likely to continue for the last 50. So the question is not really whether one is for it or against it. It's how does one make and contribute to London being a better place given that proposition. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Offering is finished. There will be some a bit of an opportunity before the break to take some questions on that. So thank you very much. That's a fantastic oversight. Our next speaker is Ian Gordon. Ian is the Professor of Human Geography here at LSE. And what Ian's now going to talk about is the implications for residential displacement. Ian.
Right, thank you very much. I'm going to talk in a very broad brush way, covering a narrower territory than Jeremy. One of the things that Jeremy's graph reminded me of was my great record as a forecaster in relation to London. About 25 years ago, I think, Tony Champion published an early observation talking about the momentous change in London's population growth. And I produced a response which talked about the momentary change because it all depended upon international migration, which was clearly not sustainable beyond the very short term. Largely on the basis that we understood from the previous 25 years or so the dynamics of London population and what was acceptable and attainable within Greater London, and this clearly wasn't part of it. And actually my presentation really carries on with worrying about, well, how on earth is it that we have managed to do this, and what grounds are there to believe that we can actually sustain it beyond the present? It's an exercise in accountancy. All the words in the title might be understood in quite different ways. Mine is simply a rather accounting arithmetical one. I want to say that arithmetically we can think about the potential for accommodating or the actuality of accommodating a given population within a particular area in terms of densification, meaning specifically here, not the mayor's policy, but cramming more people into the existing number of rooms that we have. Development, again, not in a conventional sense necessarily, but increasing the number of rooms that we have or the number of rooms we have in occupation, or displacement, pushing the existing population somewhere else. Pushing, I don't necessarily mean pushing. They may well choose to fly or they may choose to move on or all sorts of things of that sort. So it's an exercise in arithmetic and trying to understand the arithmetic of this and the potential future arithmetics. And in no way critical of Jeremy, but of some of his previous political masters, I think. Two of the things that strike me about London mayoral plans since 2001, since growth in London was declared to be inevitable and something which had to be accommodated, is that they seem to avoid all recognition, maybe not quite so much just at the moment, from what Jeremy is saying, of two things. One, the driving role of international migration in the population turnaround, and wanting to say, oh, it's all about births, rather than about primarily about that. And secondly, still wanting, I think, to avoid talking about the integration, the interaction between the housing markets and housing market supply and demand inside Greater London and what happens outside. And I'm pretty sure on the basis it's politically too delicate to start raising questions about how people outside might have to provide space to accommodate growth which we think is being stimulated inside London. Now, I think we perhaps we've got to the point where we have to stop being silent about those. But I think the size of the gap, which Jeremy was pointing to, between estimated housing need and a half-credible supply growth, makes it crucial to look much more closely at how, rather than at home. I think I was at home at the time. Immigrant-induced growth has been accommodated so far, with a realistic view about displacement effects. Displacement I think perhaps it isn't understood within the territory we're talking about. So within Greater London, within the Greater South East and beyond that, it's not really a matter of people moving vast distances. It's mostly about chains of effects in which people get encouraged to move in different directions in relatively short steps, maybe in accord with subconscious prejudices or their own immediate interest, and then producing knock-on effects and knock-on effects and knock-on effects, which stretch probably 100 miles at least outwards, this displacement. So a realistic view of how this thing operates, and also about the dynamic effects of migrant settlement, things we started to talk about before the break, of what happens to second generations and their preferences, but also what happens to the first generation 10, 20 years after arriving, and how their expectations of housing, as of other things, change, as hopefully their economic position changes. So the backstory, you've heard before, but my version of the backstory says that for 50 years, from 1939, the Greater London population contracted because of rising prosperity, which increased the demands, the expectations which people had about their personal space, in terms of ground space particularly, which was not accommodatable inside the Green Belt. Since the floods, I've taken to calling this the Green Dam, because it conjures up a bit more clearly the fact that green belts, green dams, stop things for so long until you start getting overflow beyond that, until the pressure builds up inside. So inside the Green Dam, there's a limited availability of land, for housing at least. This situation of something driven by prosperity changed in the late 1980s, I think, in two reasons. One was the accumulation of yuppie types, people like most of us, various stages, who've been single and graduates and had a stronger taste for urban life than the average Brit has done, the average Londoner has done in the past, but also upswings in international migration, which seem to be driven by, on the one hand, external stimuli, including things which led refugees towards this country, and weak border control during some periods, particularly between the mid-90s and the mid-2000s. The impact on the London population from migration, I think obviously, is not one for one. So for each extra 1,000 migrants who come into London, we don't add 1,000 onto the London population. There's an interdependence between the different kinds of migrant flows we're talking about. There's clear indications of displacement into inter-regional movement, flows with the rest of the UK. Simple graphs, such as this one, which I've been selling versions of for the last 20 years, I think, probably. So the red line is net international migration to Greater London, and the blue line is net migration with the rest of the UK. And there does seem to be some kind of symmetry between these two. Tim Hatton, some years ago, produced a very nice econometric paper which demonstrated the maths of this across southern England and suggested that there was a displacement of about 50%. So for each extra 1,000 coming into London, roughly speaking, 500 people were moving out, causally associated as a consequence of that. I've no idea how to go backwards with this thing, but maybe we won't go backwards. So I'm interested in that. Right. Okay, so what we've been doing in incomplete pieces of analysis is, first of all, to look, as Antoine was doing early on, at change between the last two censuses, so look rather statistically in a broad brush way. And what I've been looking at particularly is the one novelty, I think, the relationship between changes in numbers of occupied rooms, which is not something that people commonly look at, and average persons per room, on the one hand, and changes in five broad population groups, the UK-born, then migrants split between people who come from poor countries, people who come from rich countries, and people who came in the last decade and people who came before that. So it seems to me the two crucial distinctions are recency of arrival and whether you come from a rich country or whether you come from a poor country, which has nothing to do with educational qualifications or skill of anything of that sort, but is quite fundamental to some motivations for being here, but also for how people get placed inside the London labour market economy. And doing this across the greater southeast, so London, eastern region as was, southeastern region as was, at a couple of spatial scales, at neighbourhoods, lower super output areas as they are now, which is what Antoine was mapping, where any densification that's going on in terms of people per room looks as though it ought to be simply a question of the densities at which individuals from different groups come to live, choose to live, get forced to live, rather than something about the housing market per se, because it's only a small fraction of the housing market. And then also looking at something like sub-housing market areas, Mike Coombs called the lower tier of housing market areas, of which there's about 7 or 8 across London, but 72 across the greater southeast. And at which scale, it seems as though the balance between demand and supply, including the effects on that of migration of various sorts, is liable to have some impact upon how the growth is accommodated and in terms of densification, probably via house prices and rents, but I don't do those sorts of things. I'm not a housing person. Right, I've got some numbers mostly is what I would want to use by way of argument. There's some regression results here which I'm going to flip past, and I want to try and persuade you of some of this by maps to start with, and see how far we get. So this is a version of one of Antoine's maps, I guess. So this is great. The analysis goes much wider afield, but it's much easier to see maps in relation to Greater London. So this is Greater London a bit beyond. And the inner line is one version of inner London. And this shows, as Antoine said, that people who come from rich countries within the last decade have very heavily concentrated in this inner west segment of London, not much beyond that. This is the poor country arrivals, and again, it's rather like some of Antoine's maps, even when we add them up together. Four big blocks, three blobs rather than blocks, perhaps, three of them north of the river and a more diffuse one south of the river. Retain the pattern in your mind. This is the growth in persons per room between 2001 and 2011, which I think looks like a fuzzy version of the last map, essentially. We can go through a lot of statistics to try and persuade you of this and why it's a fuzzy version of the last map, but I think it's convincingly, just in terms of looking at them, it's something pretty much like the last map. There must be some kind of causal connection there. This is a much messier map, which you probably can't read from the back of the room. It's quite interesting speckled thing. This is the growth in numbers of rooms. Well, strictly it's the number of occupied rooms, or rooms in occupied dwellings, between the censuses, which you can pick out various ad hoc developments in Docklands and around that. If you want to find a pattern inside London, I've squinted at this. Yellow has got more rather than blue. It's somewhere rather down the middle, I think, is where there's a bit more room growth in general, which is quite interesting in the light of Antoine's maps. It's certainly not where either of the sets of migrant concentrations are. It is rather like where he sees the UK population as having grown, and for where maybe other people are being evicted. But anyhow, there isn't a simple relationship between where rooms are being built and where migrants have come in from outside the country, though there is a simple relationship between densification and where they've come in. This is a map of some estimates. So this is an attempt to do something which soon, if I'd been faster on my feet like Eric, we would have got from the longitudinal study. But this is an attempt to try and estimate the dispersal of the populations that lived in London in 2001. So this is an estimate of the net effect of relocation by people from rich countries who were in London in 2001 over the previous decade. Basically, you can see them moving out of the area of concentration of the new migrants, which is the area of their concentration before that, not terribly far on the whole, into northwest outer London preponderantly. Whoops, lost it. Somewhere, if I hadn't skipped past it, you would have seen a similar map for people from poor countries, which also shows them moving out of their existing concentrations, but they're much more diffuse, and actually moving further afield. Though really, when we draw the maps, we can't find a general net gains anywhere for a long way out, as I'll show you in a moment. So in broad terms, say statistically, if we think about four rings of this region, inner London, outer London, the outer metropolitan area, and the area beyond that in the greater southeast, what we find over the decade is that population grew in each of those rings throughout that decade, but it grew fastest in the inner London, fastest towards the core. It reflected growth in the foreign-born, particularly people who came from poor countries, and that was particularly true in outer London, as Antoine's maps as have shown. And in outer London, UK-born numbers fell significantly. So it wasn't just the proportion of the population that fell, the actual numbers fell significantly in outer London. But also reflected growth in people coming from rich countries, concentrated particularly in inner London. And there was a dispersal of early arrivals from both of these groups, though the poor country group went further afield, including beyond the greater southeast as a whole, as I'll suggest to you with the numbers in a moment. Thirdly, room numbers also grew right across the Greater South East. They grew most rapidly in Inner London as compared with any of the other rings, but it was very patchy even in there, and it wasn't particularly in immigrant areas anywhere. But in London, population per room also grew very notably, and this growth in population per room accommodated, in accounting terms, 40% of the total growth in London. Right? So 40% of the total growth which has been accommodated inside Greater London has been not through densification of a planning kind, it's been through packing more people in per room, in the occupied rooms. Notably in or near areas of new poor country arrival. These are two pages of numbers which document those simple points. Just the dispersal one, here, the two right columns, which say these are based on estimates at this stage, estimates of how many people would actually have died or emigrated since the last census in order to derive the net picture. One of the things you can see on the right-hand side here is that previous migrants from poor countries seem to have been reduced everywhere. I mean, they've reduced particularly strongly inside Greater London, but the net growth to compensate for this has to be somewhere out with the whole of the Greater South East. As one of the pieces of evidence which shows that looking at the Greater South East isn't looking at far enough to understand the housing system here. Displacement and dispersal occurs over substantially wider territory. Okay, into numbers, or into talking about numbers. So there's three things I've been crunching numbers about trying to understand. One is the causes of densification and how far these actually tie to different sorts of migration. Secondly, about development, and thirdly, displacement. So analysing 2001-2011 changes across these neighbourhood things, we find, quite apart from migration, there is a significant effect of job accessibility on densification. In other words, areas which have better access to jobs increase their density of occupancy per rooms over this decade. So it was seen to reflect increased attractiveness in this period partly. And it's statistically significant. Even if nothing, no population had grown, it means that in Inner London we would have expected population per room to have grown by about 6% compared with about 3% on similar assumptions out at the edge of the region. So there's a significant difference, not a very big one, but it is a significant difference. But the strongest effect, by far, in looking at the associations here at the local level, is with the rate of new arrivals during the decade from poor countries. And just crunching the numbers that are directly at that level, it seems as though, if you can understand this, 55% of the accommodation, the ways in which these extra people were accommodated, was by packing more people in per room at this neighbourhood level. Right? If we contrast that and we put that alongside each of the other causes of population growth in the area, and at the other extreme you find for UK-born, 10% of the extra growth, all the negative, was reflected in the changes in population per room. So there's a great sensitivity only for migrants from poor countries in this context. If we look at what happens to the changes in numbers of people who came into the country before 2001 and who've been moving around, what does their moving around do to density of occupation in particular areas? Well, there is a significant effect, but it's only about half that of new migrants from poor countries. So for both poor country migrants and rich country migrants, we find a significant effect 10 years, 20 years, whatever it is later. When they move about, if they go in, they increase densification, but to nothing like the extent that new poor country migrants do. All these things are generally weaker amongst rich country arrivals, and there's a difference between the ones who come into Inner London and those who go to the outer rings in the South East, and it's a striking difference. So Inner London has the main concentration across the whole of the Greater South East of people coming in from rich countries. They seem to be quite atypical in character, at least in how they interact with the housing market, and I think they probably are in character. And it's quite possible that their arrival has no effect on densification at all. And we can think of local examples, and some of them you might look at on the map there around parts of Kensington and Chelsea, and say, well, we think there's probably a negative association. The one rich country migrant is managing to occupy half the space of the people who were previously there. So there's some perverse effects, but on the whole, it seems to be more or less neutral. So densification is about the immediate accommodation, the first 10 years, of people who arrive from poor countries. If we step back a bit and look at the housing market to some extent, and look at the local housing market areas and say, well, what effect does it have if there's population growth occurring from one of these sources in the areas around your locality, in the local housing market area? We can also find effects there. Those don't depend upon where people came from. But it's about a 25% effect on the densities as a result of growth from all sources. So it might be, adding these things together, that migrants from poor countries are 80% being accommodated through densification, not necessarily 55% certainly for them, the other 25% for people living in the areas around this. Okay. Oh, right, the thing I was going to say at the bottom is, if we do the arithmetic on that and say, well, how much difference did that make to densification room level in inner London compared with other parts of the region, we found it's that factor alone, the poor country arrivals, would have pushed density per room up by 13% inside inner London compared with 3% in the outer edge of the greater southeast. So a much, much stronger effect than the simple attractive one of job accessibility, the dominant influence on densification within inner London, and densification at the room level seems to be the dominant form of densification that actually occurred across this decade, rather than development. Right, I'm running out of time. These will more quickly. Trying to do the same sort of analysis in terms of development, which means in this case, well, can we show that the number of rooms coming into effective use over the decade responded to migration in the areas? Well, if we do it at the local housing market area, which seems to be the appropriate one to do it, there is no statistically significant effect. Right? If we do it at the neighbourhood level, which shouldn't be the relevant level, there does seem to be some, and there does seem to be some from rich country migrants. It looks as though over 20% might be absorbed that way. This is perverse. It can only be a redistribution of opportunities within segments of London. But the broad story is we have no reason to believe that there's actually any significant impact upon housing supply coming about as a result of in-migration by new arrivals by either of those groups, at least from this kind of analysis. And there's some numbers there which purport to support it. Lastly, displacement. We can't do displacement looking at a locality level. There's too many. Everything's dependent upon everything else, and it's hopeless to try and do that. The only way in which I think we can crack this is by looking at it in time series and looking at the levels of the broad regions, Greater London and the Greater South East as a whole. Doing this, what we find is that those net outflows from London to the rest of the country are very sensitive to some national factors. They're very sensitive to the strength of the UK housing market, housing demand, and when that's strong, people move out, which is consistent with the idea that the normal thing in prosperous times is for people to get out of London, not because of white flight peculiarly, but because their housing aspirations in aggregate can't be satisfied inside this space. There's some effect of overall conditions in the region as a whole on this thing, none from house prices or unemployment inside London, but also international migration gains into London, this is not unlike the Hatton result, appear to be 40% displaced into other areas outside Greater London, with a two-year lag. Right? So if you look at the relationship, 2 years after migrants arrive, we find an upturn in net out-migration from London, equivalent to 40% of the international migrants who'd come in before. Housing market processes intervene between, I assume. It's primarily beyond the Greater South East. This effect's occurring beyond where we were looking. Maybe it's inside Peter Hall's Greater South East, out in Northamptonshire and Dorset and Wiltshire, I think actually is where some of it is occurring. But conspicuously, if you look at the rest of the Greater South East, we don't find any such connection at all. Right? Now, if this was a labour market phenomenon rather than a housing market phenomenon, I think we'd expect to find the same kind of displacement going on right across this region. There's no evidence at all that migration into the Greater South East affects the balance of international migration, affects the balance of domestic flows for that area. And I think that's consistent with the assumption here that this is all about displacement inside a tightly constrained housing market inside the Greenbelt. It's not about the labour market, and it's not about some more general response. Last point, I'll shut up, almost. Findings for densification and development before suggest, to me at least, that displacement ought to be engendered particularly by rich country migrants, since they weren't being accommodated through densification and not through poor country migrants. And I have to say, when we do the analysis at the regional level, you can't find any evidence of a difference between them at all. So at the regional scale, it seems as though there's the same kind of effect going on, even though locally there must be substantially more displacement occurring as a result of rich country arrivals, because they're not simply being packed into more rooms. I've lost my conclusion, so we'll stop. Time to think about it, is what the conclusion says. Thank you.
Thanks very much.